So you all have the eager look of wanting to hear what I have prepared, but I haven't prepared much. So please be indulgent. Let me first remind you and me of where we were. So the main problem we're studying is for the conductivity equation for which we defined a Dirichlet to Neumann map. We want to recover gamma from lambda gamma. That's the problem. We then made the change of dependent variable. We said W is gamma to the 1/2 U. I hope I have that right. And then W satisfies the Schrödinger equation omega, where the potential is connected to the conductivity this way. And so we defined a Dirichlet to Neumann map for this equation. Which is dW dNu on the boundary. And so we observe, if you calculate the connection between the Dirichlet to Neumann map from lambda gamma to lambda q, there's a formula connecting them, namely lambda q is gamma to the minus 1/2 lambda gamma plus 1/2 d gamma d nu gamma to the 1/2. So we need a preliminary step, which we may have forgotten about by now, which is interesting in its own right, of determining gamma on the boundary and d gamma d nu on the boundary from lambda gamma. So the main problem is finding the conductivity inside the body from the Dirichlet to Neumann map. There's a separate argument, which is non-trivial, of finding the conductivity on the boundary and its normal derivative. Once you have that, you can plug that in here. So we'll do this later. Once we have that, we will So the problem is then reduced. Reduced to recovering lambda q, sorry, q from lambda q. Okay, so for the latecomers, I have warned everybody that I'll have to wing it today. But so thank you for asking that. So the order of the thing is I give you the Dirichlet to Neumann map, lambda gamma. Okay? That's what we measure with electrodes on the body. Voltage to current map. I will teach you later how, in some sense, it's a formula to recover from that the conductivity and its normal derivative on the boundary from the Dirichlet to Neumann map. Okay, so now you know the conductivity on the surface and you know the its normal derivative. You substitute those in here and you find lambda q. So now I have a separate problem. Here's the definition of lambda q. Definition, it's the normal derivative of this. I look at the map q from lambda q, and I ask, can we invert this? So from the Dirichlet to Neumann map for the conductivity, I find lambda q. From lambda q, we will have a, so this is where most of the work will go. We'll have a way to find q. And once we have q, we'll find gamma. And in fact, we'll actually find gamma from lambda q. We don't need to go through q. Right. So one way would be you know gamma on the boundary already. Once you know q, you could just solve the equation for gamma 1/2. But we will not do that. We'll have a better way. Okay, so the main thing is this is our data. We want gamma and q. All right, so how do we go about doing that? Well, so we had a theorem. I will put in the details in a moment because we'll need them. Let's call it theorem one, which is in the forward problem. Which was that given q in LP of omega, p between 1 and 2, um, what's the form? Laplace sine naught over some sine naught. Well, I may as well put in the assumption. So sine naught was positive. What else? Bounded. So given such a Q, right, bounded, actually we have LQ on. R2. And the gradient in LP we found we have for every k a complex number not equal to zero, a solution, psi xk of the Schrödinger equation in all of Rn, R2. A unique with, so the way you pin it down is you say psi is like e to the I k z at infinity. So that means more precisely this minus that is in LP tilde, which I should have called star, LP star times L infinity. So P tilde is the exponent and moreover, this is in W1p tilde, so you don't need that for uniqueness, but it follows out of the construction, and we have an estimate. Psi e to the minus I k z minus 1 W S P tilde is 1 over k to the 1 minus s times the constant times the LP norm of q for s between 0 and 1 and k sufficiently large. So this theorem we proved very carefully. With all the I's crosses and T's crossed. I's daughter, I'm sorry. Okay? that it should be in W1. So far that has nothing to do with the inverse problem. It's just the fact of life that if you have a nice potential, you have a nice solution of the Schrödinger equation in all of R2. Moreover, so what's special to inverse problems is simply that we would be interested in such a solution. Without this kind of questions, people would have no reason to to study solutions that behave like these growing exponentials. But there they are. Theorem 2, so first of all, before theorem 2, we have a little piece of notation. We have mu of x, so notation. Mu of xk is this psi out of which we factored out the growing exponential. I say it's growing. Well, it's growing in some places, decaying in other places. And another little piece of notation which seems to have been adopted by the world is e to the ikz plus k bar z bar. So you take this solution and you ask, for reasons which I've explained, you ask what is the derivative of this with respect to k bar. So one reason you ask this is by analogy to what happens in 1D inverse scattering. The other reason you ask it is that the equation which mu satisfies has k entering with something like something like that. So k enters analytically, therefore, if mu is a solution, d mu dk bar is a solution. And so theorem 2, which we almost finished proving, is that d mu dk bar equals equals so out of this calculation came out this what I call scattering transform. Or gamma, if you want, since Q is connected to gamma, E minus K mu X K quantity bar. Okay? So we spent quite a bit of energy trying to prove this. Now, yes? Ah, right. No. X is Z. So Z is X1 plus I X2 throughout the course. K is what? Oh. Right. And zeta is kik. Very good question. These function spaces are in X with k as a parameter, but soon we will turn the tables and we'll be working in function spaces in k. Which is why we've been careful to try to keep track of the dependence in K. In particular, where? Oh, here. Yes. This is in X, and these are in X. But since you asked, I want to point out that one of the advantages of having this here is that once SP tilde is bigger than 2, which is possible, so in particular, since SP tilde is bigger than 2, if S is bigger than 2 over P tilde, which is less than 1, P tilde is bigger than 2. So 2 over P tilde is less than 1. By Sobolev embedding, this becomes a pointwise statement. So psi e minus ikz is, well, psi is continuous in X. So for every k, we have an actual function of x, and for every x, we have a function of k. So this is because of this is by Sobolev embedding, right? Remember, W SP tilde is contained in C0. In fact, it's contained in C alpha, with alpha, holder space with alpha equal S minus 2 over, yeah, 2 over P tilde. So the moment S is bigger than 2 over P tilde, this is continuous. Okay, so some of the headache of this is that it doesn't quite occur in the spaces in which we constructed that. And so we had to do this in weighted Sobolev spaces. Let me come back to that. Well, maybe I should put it in now. So here the assumption was Q is in LP rho, weight rho bigger than 1. So I need Q to be more decaying at infinity than the typical LP function. Then for any k which is not an exceptional point, forget about that right now. So this is in the W1 P tilde minus beta topology, beta being bigger than 2 over P tilde. So again, if you look at this as a function of x, so these are just numbers, this has absolute value 1, mu is roughly like 1. So as a function of x, this is not in LP tilde. It's not decaying at all. Okay? So we can't expect this to be in LP tilde. That's why we throw in this minus beta, which makes the function 1 be in LP tilde. What's the question, Katrin? This is in x. So this is for any k, this happens in the of R2 x topology. But again, it's pointwise in k, and because of this, 1 p tilde, it's also pointwise in x. So where, out of this calculation, came out T? T is simply the Fourier transform of Q mu. Yes, sir? Right. Right, that's just an extra. Well, but it's better than, it's L infinity plus continuous. So that's the main thing. So on the first two boards, we have basically the problem defined. On the middle two boards, we have the forward problem. Right? So if you give me a Q, here are some things we can construct. We can construct mu, we can construct T, and we have this basic equation, let's call it star. Now on this board, I'm now going to start talking about the inverse problem. So this looks so well organized, it's almost as if I had prepared. The inverse problem will have two pieces. One is two main pieces. One is given lambda Q will calculate T. And piece number two is given T. Once T is known, we're going to look at this equation star so we'll calculate mu using star. That's right. That's very good. So instead of using, let's be more precise, by solving star as a differential equation in K. And that's when we'll switch to spaces in K. Now, once you have mu, I indicated to you that you can get Q. But we'll also have, so this, let's call this 2-1, 2-2. Well, actually, this should have been, here somewhere. So, pardon me, this is actually still a theorem in the forward problem. So from 3, I didn't breakdown in my beautiful setup of the, on the blackboards. There's a little theorem which I haven't mentioned yet to you, which has to do with what happens when K is near zero. Right? Throughout this, I said, don't worry about K equals zero. Well, there's a theorem that tells you precisely what happens when K is zero. namely, mu minus that psi naught over there . There's a little constant here, which I'll tell to you, tell you later. In the appropriate weighted Sobolev space is less than k to the epsilon. So I haven't put the assumptions in yet, and I haven't told you what epsilon is. Let's just call this star star. For k small, right. For, let's say, k close to zero. So what's this C infinity? Well, it turns out psi naught, we'll analyze, looks like C infinity plus, let's say, little o of x as x goes to infinity. So can normalize psi naught to be like 1. No, 1 at infinity. Oh, here? I don't want to worry about in what sense. So I'm talking semi-formally right now. What I'm saying is, forget about it, just think of C infinity as 1 right now. And we'll talk about the details later. What I'm saying is, we're talking forward problem. So I said Q is of this form. Okay? a sort of a psi that behaves like this turns out, it's not an extra assumption, turns out has, it's like a constant plus less. Oh, one. Yeah. I'm sorry. Goes to zero. I mean, goes to... Okay. Yeah. Limit of psi naught is C infinity exists. This is a fact. Which is a small fact right now. So a psi naught that satisfies that has a limit at infinity. Suppose that limit is 7, right? Then I can divide by 7, not change my Q. And now psi naught will behave like 1 at infinity. If you like 7 better than 1, then you'll have pay the price by putting 1 over 7 here. Okay? All right, so that's a detail. Coming back, what does this tell us? This tells us that up to this normalization headache, when k is 0, mu is very nice. After all, look at this, right? This psi naught satisfies this equation. As psi. So what this is telling you is that there's justice in the world. When k is 0, mu is psi naught. Okay? Again, it will not be in WSP tilde. You have to throw in a weight. But basically, the limit as k goes to 0 of mu is psi naught. Divided by 7 if you forgot to do that before. But psi naught is... does not depend on k. Yes, thank you. This notation psi naught is not innocent. That's right. That's exactly why I call it psi naught. Thank you very much for noticing. But more than that, it's basically gamma to the 1/2. Right? I knew you were going to say that. Okay. So there is a gamma, which is the conductivity of the body, which I don't know. Out of this gamma, which I don't know, I construct this Q, which I don't know. From this Q that I don't know, I know one can construct a psi or a mu. With the following property, mu satisfies star, and mu satisfies double star. So in particular, mu, this family of mu, as k goes to 0, is basically the gamma to the 1/2, which I don't know. Well, is given as that. As I said, from the gamma that I don't know, I've constructed a Q. So if you wish, you can call psi 0 gamma to the 1/2. Let's be even less innocent and call it gamma to the 1/2. So again, forward problem. If I know gamma, and you give me gamma, I find a Q. From this, I construct the psi with the property star. And psi, as k goes to 0, a property double star, turns out to turn to gamma. I didn't impose that. That comes out of this construction. Now, inverse problem. You give me lambda gamma. So you're no longer giving me the conductivity, you're giving me the Dirichlet to Neumann map. From the Dirichlet to Neumann map, I calculate gamma and d gamma d nu. And therefore, lambda q. So now I've got lambda q. I will tell you how from lambda q, this I will tell you in the next hour, one can find t. So I don't yet know how to find gamma, but I know how to find this particular function of k associated with gamma. Then once we have t, so you don't need to give me anything else, right? Once I have this, I know t. Once I have t, I can solve this problem. And once I have mu of xk for k different from 0, right, I will ask, what does this look like as k approaches 0? And from that limit, I will get my gamma to the 1/2. Right. At infinity or at 0? At both. Right. So, well, it's the whole plane. I mean, if Q is enormously singular, okay? So, so at infinity, that's clear. At infinity, the condition on mu will be that this equals 1 as k goes to infinity. Right? Which we've been working very hard to do. That's already, we know that's a fact here. By Sobolev embedding, as k goes to infinity, mu goes to 1 pointwise in x. But we'll put a space on it. Now, what about as k goes to 0? Now it's getting tricky, right? I cannot just say, that's my condition. So that's why I call psi naught and not gamma to the 1/2. So I'll simply say that I mean informally mu bounded near 0. So think of analytic functions. Okay, you ask me why boundary condition. Let's think of analytic functions. In other words, the simple case where t happens to be identically zero. Right? Then I'm looking for an analytic function mu. But I only know it's analytic away on c minus zero. Right? If I tell you it's bounded near zero, then you know it's analytic everywhere. And if I tell you it tends to one, then you know it's one. So these two conditions will pin down the analytic function. And I don't have to tell you what it is at zero. Or the other way around, there are other situations where I could say the function is bounded and it's equal to 19 at zero. That also pins it down. So you can tell me what it is at infinity and tell me it's bounded near zero, or you can say it's bounded near infinity and tell me what it is at zero. And I'll choose this. Okay, maybe this is a good space. Okay, so you see how it'll flow. The inverse problem is part one, I'll find t. Part two, given t, we find mu. Part two, two is recover gamma to the 1/2 as the limit as k goes to zero of mu. Right. Well, I'm actually not interested in Q if I'm doing the initial problem. It turns out that so here's there's an alternative to 2-2. If you look at the so you get your out of 2-1 you have mu of xk. Now you look at the so this is closer to what I showed you in 1D, right? You take this mu. Such a mu turns out to have, just like an analytic function, right? It has a Taylor series at infinity. First term one, the 1 over k term is mu infinite some function of x. This function of x is I think it's something like Q is d bar mu infinity. Some constant here. But this is for nice enough t. So t has to be decaying, sufficiently decaying, for such an expansion to hold. T is like a nonlinear Fourier transform of Q, so decay of t corresponds to smoothness of Q. so nice enough, decaying enough. Enough tea, so, or smooth enough to smooth enough Q. So it turns out for our assumption here, that's not good enough. Whereas this works for the kind of Q, right? So I was stuck on this. This is the standard way that everybody gets Q out of mu. It doesn't work in the class of Q we're considering. So this is somehow a new idea, which has the advantage that it works in the class of Q that we're considering, and moreover, it gives you directly the conductivity, which is what I was after. Right. Small k works better, and small k gives me directly gamma, which means I don't need to do this step here. If I want gamma, if I first get Q, then I need to solve. So in the reconstruction, this is a headache. I mean, think of numerically, right? You need a solver for minus Laplace plus Q to do this, whereas here you don't. And in fact, we won't have to take the limit. I'll tell you what it is once we have a formula for mu. We'll have an integral formula for this. Okay. See you in 10 minutes. Then we'll decide which will. So is the logic clear? Is the order clear? Because at the very least we should do that. Yes, yes, please. No problem. I did too. Oh, right. So that's one of the to-dos. No, haven't done that. So, to do. So, one is from lambda gamma to gamma on the boundary and d gamma d nu on the boundary. It's completely independent of the rest. And it's interesting. So let me give you a hand-waving argument of why it's interesting. So at first you might think, well, maybe I've said this before. If I'm sitting here on the surface and I can put electrodes and measure currents and voltages, I should be able to tell what the resistance is on the boundary. Sounds obvious. Now, what happens is, when you put a voltage between these two points, the current goes, some of the current might go on the boundary, but some of the current might go like this. And so the idea in this proof is to use the so-called skin effect, where if we somehow put in a highly oscillatory input, it will tend to stay close to the boundary. So we will not be including information from the interior, which in this step we are not interested in. Now, but that's somehow a little, it's the slippery of the language. I think when physicists talk about skin effect, they mean highly oscillatory in time. Here we're looking at, there's no time here, it's the what they would call DC, direct current. What we just have one elliptic equation, right? There's no time dependence. And so instead we will put in highly oscillatory in space. So spatially highly oscillatory data here turns out to stay near the boundary. And so we recover that. If things are very smooth, this is done using pseudo-differential operators. So if the boundary and the conductivity are smooth, lambda gamma is a pseudo-differential operator. With symbol, so how do you find the symbol of a pseudo-differential operator? You apply it to something like this, which is highly oscillatory, and you can't. And the top-order symbol turns out to be lambda. I mean, for large xi. So this is our spatially highly oscillatory thing, and it gives you the conductivity. Now, the next term has the normal derivative, right? The zeroth order term has d gamma d nu plus, I don't know, it's something else. Okay, so I'm working under the assumption that the boundary is Lipschitz and gamma has two derivatives at most in LP. That's not good enough for this. So I came up with another proof. Yeah, at least two derivatives. So I came up with another proof, which shows you how you can. So Adrian's trick of avoiding IDOs using integration by parts. So I could lecture about this, I mean, not today, but I could lecture about this. And I could not mention the words pseudo-differential operators if you don't want to hear them. On the other hand, I could try to present a little bit about pseudo-differential operators and how the symbol calculus gives you this. So let's take a vote on that. So would you like a little crash course on pseudo-differential operators? How many people would say yes? 1, 2, 3, 4. Pardon me? It depends. All right. You mean if we have time? It's not necessary. I mean, if all you want to know is my solution to the Calderon problem in 2D, which is what most of the course has been about, this is not needed. So this is just an excuse for a side trip. How is what? Illuminating. Yeah, I will certainly, as I've done throughout, I will try to motivate it. I think, yeah, it's not just... I definitely want to show you my trick, because it's very nice. But... okay, so we won't take the full vote right now. So that's one of the things on the to-do list. The next thing on the to-do list, so that's one. Two, is theorem three, and behavior. So this is behavior of mu and T. For k near zero. All right, so this is technical. I would say it's not super illuminating. So what the issue there is, is that in some sense, Laplacian in 2D is not as nice an operator as Laplacian plus KD bar, which is what we've been working with. So not as nice as this. So, for instance, a solution of Laplace psi naught equals Q psi naught might grow. So we have to be careful about this. It might grow like a logarithm at infinity. So there is a but somewhat illuminating. So there is a trick which is known by physicists and used in scattering theory about this low K singularity in 2D, so dealing with, so which I learned by reading something of Barry Simons, which of course had nothing to do with the inverse problem, dealing with the log singularity for K near zero. So it's a singularity, but it's somehow a one-dimensional singularity, and you take that out, and you're left with something nice. So the plus of talking about this is to explain this. And the other plus is that it somehow gives you a piece of the proof. The minus is that it's, I would describe it as somehow more boring than the other things. So how do we go on that one? How many people would like to see what? You want to see how theorem theory is proved. Who is with Alex on that? Yeah, okay. Katrin doesn't believe anything unless it's proved. So, and okay. So to keep me honest, but then again, I will at least try to sketch this, okay? And if we get to something really boring, then maybe I'll write down the result and see if you want to believe it or you want to see it. In any case, it won't happen today. Then, of course, the main things that are left are three is properties of T. Maybe I'll do a little bit of that today. In other words, we're going to solve this PDE, right? Partial, well, it's a first order PDE, partial derivatives in K. Yeah, elliptic. Elliptic first order PDE, d bar k. ddk1 plus. So it's in two dimensions and it's ddk1 plus I ddk2 is the operator. But of course, if you do something like this, you need some assumption, and T of k is now a coefficient. So just like before, we had an elliptic equation with variable coefficient q. You can't do anything unless you make some assumptions on q, right? I mean, you can have very wild solutions unless you make assumptions on q, which we've tried to keep to a minimum. Similarly here, you need some assumptions on t. So before you solve this, you need some properties of T. This is not long, because we've already done most of the work once 3 is done. So behavior of T near 0 comes from theorem 3. Behavior of T for large K comes from this. So that won't take long. So then, of course, we need step 2-1, and then step 1. So let's discuss step. I don't know what to erase. I can erase this. Step 2-2 is theorem 3. Yes? Yes? I was wondering if anybody is going to... Very good. I was wondering if anybody's going to catch me on that one. I will repeat that in great detail. So I'll call it extending gamma. Very good question. What's the issue? So the issue is we start with omega. And we have a gamma. And then we define a q. Which we assume is in LP. And then we say extend Q. Extending Q is not a problem. To be identically zero outside omega. So we did that without blinking, right? We just said, let's just extend Q to be zero. So it's an LP of R2 with compact support. In particular, it's as decaying as we want. I just wanted to keep this more general, which is why I introduced this decay. But as far as our Q, it has compact support. But then the issue is, how do we extend gamma? After all, we want gamma to be rather smooth, right? So gamma to the 1/2 will be in LP by this. Laplace gamma is Q gamma to the 1/2. So I cannot just say gamma is equal to 1 outside here, because then it has a jump. So then what I did in my paper is the following. Is we extend gamma here, by a known function. So in other words, given gamma on the boundary and d gamma d nu on the boundary, we simply choose gamma tilde in W2P with gamma tilde the same boundary values. And gamma tilde identically 1 outside omega tilde, which contains, so this is omega tilde, this is omega, just extend, so that only depends on knowledge of what the boundary values are. If you know this and that, you can extend to a nice function here. Okay? What's the problem? The problem is that Q is not zero. Pardon me? Two derivatives? Because eventually I want Q to be Laplace gamma to be in LP. Yes? Right, right, but the second derivative follows. Laplace psi naught is Q psi naught. Because psi naught is bounded and Q is in LP. Well, Laplacian is enough, right? If the Laplacian is in here, I must all of the derivatives of psi naught are in LP, the gradient. And if the Laplacian is in LP, that means all the second derivatives are in LP by the boundedness of the Riesz transforms. All right. So just imagine, let's just say outside a neighborhood of omega. So imagine that psi starts to be one, identically one out here. I'm sorry, gamma tilde. Yes. So then, what I showed is let lambda tilde be the Dirichlet Neumann map for gamma tilde in omega tilde. Oh, by the way, of course, I want gamma tilde to be identical to gamma in omega. It's an extension. So here's lambda gamma here, and here's lambda tilde gamma tilde. Yes. So what I do, the issue is, what do you know and what are you given and what aren't you given? Okay, I don't know gamma inside. So this I can construct based on what I'm given. From the Dirichlet to Neumann map, I know this and I know that by the step that Sarah wants me to do, or at least caught me on. No, she didn't catch me because I said I hadn't done it. Anyway, by that step, by the boundary identification, okay? So if you know this, you can find this gamma tilde outside omega. Now, define gamma tilde to be equal to gamma in omega. Then, by this construction, gamma tilde, so first you do it in R2 minus omega, and now gamma tilde is in W2 of all of R2. So because you were careful to match these two things, now it has two derivatives in LP. Okay? So here's an extra theorem. Lambda gamma tilde determines, lambda gamma determines lambda gamma tilde. No. It's another bounded domain that encloses omega. Right. But here I don't have a jump anymore because here it's identically 1. Yes, that's right, I've smeared it out. And what I'm trying to say is that if you know what this is, which we do because we've chosen it, then the Dirichlet-to-Neumann map here also gives you the Dirichlet-to-Neumann map there. So in other words, you can propagate Dirichlet-to-Neumann maps through known regions. So once you have this theorem, we assume gamma identically 1 near the boundary without loss of generality, and therefore Q identically 0 outside the domain. So I didn't mention this here, but it is in the paper. Okay, so again, the logic. We're given the Dirichlet-to-Neumann map here. Okay, we determine this and that. We then choose a bigger domain, and the gamma tilde, some extension in between here, which is 1 near the boundary of the bigger domain. We then use this theorem to compute the Dirichlet-to-Neumann map for the bigger domain. Now, this was, I didn't think this was a big deal, but it turned out that this proof, so this is amusing, by the way. What? Amusing. Fun, as opposed to theorem 3, which is not so amusing. Yes. So it depends, right. So what this theorem does is it opens up a whole new little field. If you understand the way the Dirichlet-to-Neumann map propagates through a known medium, which I had to do to get this theorem, you can then turn that around and use the Dirichlet-to-Neumann map to determine obstacles. So remark, the proof of theorem 4 is based on a new factorization result. I mean, I'll have to show it to you. Which, as shown by Kirsch for obstacle scattering, well, let's put it this way, which is the or a main ingredient. Andreas Kirsch's method. So as I am answering this question, I'm convincing myself I should give you a lecture on this. An obstacle inverse problem is, so here we're just trying to find a conductivity, an unknown conductivity. Now suppose that you know the conductivity. Let's say we put all the electrodes on you and we already have an image of your body. But then somebody shoots you, and there's now a bullet somewhere in an... No, nobody died. It's just sitting there. And we'd like to image that bullet. Or maybe somebody has a pacemaker. So there, the issue is, suppose you now measure the Dirichlet-to-Neumann map for the exterior problem to this obstacle. Okay, so can we from that recover the obstacle? So it's not a medium coefficient problem, rather an obstacle problem. So typically when we look at each other, right, the light rays do not penetrate inside you. So what I'm looking at is a solution, let's say, of the Helmholtz equation outside of you, R3 minus some obstacle. Let's call it D so as not to confuse the issue. With U on the boundary is D, that's the exterior Dirichlet problem, or du d nu on the boundary equals D, that's the exterior Neumann problem. So this doesn't have to be light, it can be sound. These guys are called sound soft, these are called sound hard. So we're measuring fields outside some obstacle D. So by it doesn't penetrate inside, I mean I have no idea what U does inside D. That's why I call it an obstacle. So now suppose I measure U out here, the Dirichlet-to-Neumann map for this exterior problem. So let's say it's here, but then on some bigger omega, it's given to F, and I measure du d nu on the boundary. So I'm going to do this properly when we're going to define these off, but that's just to quickly answer your question. Okay? So if I have the Dirichlet-to-Neumann map out here or out at infinity, essentially, if I know what happens for every input, what's the output far away here from you, can I recover the obstacle? Can I recover D? So that's a whole other class of problems. Now, that kind of problem used to be considered harder. And typically, the way it's been solved in scattering theory, so for instance, for light, is people calculated high K, high frequency, asymptotics. So this is a very well-developed, so you have an obstacle, I repeat. I look at the solution far away. with some boundary at boundary condition far away. Let's say it's a plane wave. In Rn minus d, u minus e to the I kx is outgoing at infinity. So people calculate, and let's say u is zero on the boundary. People calculate high frequency asymptotics. That's a very technical subject in microlocal analysis. Names you might think of looking up are Andy Maida, Mike Taylor. So this is Andy Maida before Navier-Stokes. This is Andy Maida in the 70s. There are issues with glancing rays, which make these asymptotics very tricky. Okay, so it's a piece of classical analysis, high frequency behavior of these problems exterior to an obstacle. And from these asymptotics, people would read off things like curvature and so forth, right? So you can imagine if you send in a ray and you look at the reflections, you might pick out how flat or how curved the boundary is some places. And then from the curvature, maybe you find things like the boundary. So this is very, very high, very technical, very... with various restrictive assumptions and so forth. Whereas the problem of finding an obstacle at a fixed frequency, now you're not allowed to make k large. K is 1 or 10, right? There would sound even that much harder. So these are geometrical optics. For fixed frequency, geometrical optics need not hold. So for instance, sound doesn't behave like light. For light, there's a dark spot here on the other side. For sound, if you hide here, you can still hear me. It turns out that if you understand my proof of theorem 4, within 1 hour, I can give you a very soft, purely functional analysis proof that, let's say, this Dirichlet-Neumann map, this knowledge of this exterior solutions far away, determines the obstacle. So I was not in the business of obstacle recovery here. I was just playing the game of trying to extend from here to there. But it turns out you can turn that around and use this proof to find the obstacle. And what do you know? Another hour has passed. I know the feel. I know the feeling. Okay, so so I'm going to now sketch how we do, how we recover T from the Dirichlet to Neumann map. So again, the I like to think of this right as the analog of something like the reflection coefficient in 1D, scattering data. But and we like it because it came up in the D-bar equation, which I've erased. And because of the D-bar equation, it's clear how to recover, or at least we have a road on how to get back to the potential or the conductivity from T. So T is the data we'd rather have if we had our druthers. And so it seems to be a typical thing in many inverse problems that somehow the natural mathematical data is not the one that's physically measured. So step one is the attempt to get from one to the other. So it's this connecting somehow these two worlds. In one world, people had things like T's, and use D-bar to, not in this, well, actually even in this problem, use D-bar to find mu, mostly for the purpose of solving nonlinear PDEs based on the KdV story. And then in another world, we had these physical inverse problems. I give you the Dirichlet to Neumann map, find the conductivity. So step one tells you there's a connection between this physical data and this mathematical transform. Now, so first recall that if you define the Dirichlet to Neumann map in the weak sense, so definition of Dirichlet to Neumann map. Using weak solutions. Where U solves the Schrödinger equation, which means Gesundheit, which means this is zero. This Dirichlet integral is zero for all V smooth of compact support. But now if V is smooth, but it's not equal to zero on the boundary, then this integral is no longer zero for such a weak solution. And in fact, it's equal to this. So, and V, let's say anything in H1 omega. Pardon me? Yes. U on the boundary trace is F. So here, F and G are both in H1 half. And so from this, we obtained okay, so in case I got disorganized towards the end of the previous hour, let me just summarize it by saying that in answer to your question about how we extend gamma, that forced me to talk about this theorem, and I see there's some interest in it, and I realized this by itself would make an interesting. So it's now added to the to-do list, and I think it would be fun. So if you also write down, yes? Right. Yes. But now there will be something on V. So now lambda zero of G by the same token is equal to this. And that's also the same. Lambda zero is symmetric, you can flip it on the other thing. So now if we subtract these two, wait, but here I have to, where V is in H1 and Laplace V is a solution of this equation. Sorry. But now U is just anything. So now I choose U to be that and V to be this. And so subtracting, this is review, so that's why I go a little faster on it. Maybe not fast enough for some of you. So we get QUV. So this is a basic identity. I'm going to use several times now. So it's basically a trivial integration by parts. Okay, maybe I should do this just, it only takes 2 minutes, but it will reinforce your intuition about what this identity is saying. So informally. U del V minus V del, yes, del U. If Laplacian V is 0 and Laplacian U, sorry, the other way, shucks, V Laplace U minus U Laplace V. Laplace U is QU, so this is QUV. Laplace V is 0. Right? On the other hand, by Green's identity, this is V du d nu minus U dv d nu. Which is G Dirichlet-Neumann map Q of F minus F Dirichlet-Neumann map 0 of G. dv d nu is the Dirichlet-Neumann map. And then since you can flip that on the F, this is G lambda Q minus lambda 0 F. So that's what that identity says. You could think of it as integration by parts, but in fact, if you look at the definition for weak solutions, that you don't even need to integrate by part, it's part of the definition. In some sense, right, the definition is based on thinking about integration by parts. Okay, so we have that. Now, why is this an important identity for us? Because it connects stuff on the boundary. So this is stuff we sort of know, and this is stuff inside. So it's our main tool for somehow probing on the inside by playing on the boundary. So that should be a superstar. I guess for today it's triple star. So now apply triple star to U equals psi of xk and V is e to the I k bar z bar. This function satisfies that equation, and this is anti-holomorphic and therefore harmonic. And what do we get? We get lambda q minus lambda 0 of so I could call this U on the boundary and this V on the boundary. So it's lambda Q minus lambda 0 applied to the restriction of psi paired with e to the I k bar z bar. With the measure on the boundary. Question? This? So I've replaced G by V restricted to the boundary. and this is because that's what it is. Equals, so this is now by triple star, it equals the integral over omega of q e to the I k bar z bar psi x k dx. Right? That's T. Very good. So partly because Q has compact support, this is the integral over all of R2, Q e to the I k bar z bar e to the I k z mu and that's T. Okay, so let's record this nice formula. T is the integral of e to the I k bar z bar lambda q minus lambda 0 of psi on the boundary. So this is a new formula for T, which only involves integration on the boundary instead of integration on the solid region. Thus, given lambda q, note lambda zero can be calculated since omega is given. So the only thing lambda zero depends, the Dirichlet to Neumann map for the Laplacian only depends on the boundary, I mean on omega. So if I know lambda q, I know lambda q minus lambda 0. Given lambda q, to determine t, it suffices to determine psi restricted to the boundary. Okay, so what is happening? I put a condition at infinity that determines a solution psi in all of space and forces a certain function on the boundary. So I claim the Dirichlet to Neumann map determines psi on the boundary. Note, so this is now an informal motivation. Once we get to the formal proof of this fact, it's very elegant but maybe confusing if you don't know where this came from. So I want to show you how I think of this, why this is true, and then we'll see the proof. So what happens is this. We have minus Laplace plus Q psi, identically zero in R2, and psi satisfies a condition at infinity. So, outside omega, where Q is assumed to be zero, psi is just a harmonic function. So in terms of the extension business, right, I'm really working outside omega tilde here. Q is zero. Psi is a harmonic function. I know what it does at infinity. So the condition at infinity is that it's in LP tilde so this is the condition at infinity. So this is in R2 minus omega. So that sounds like an exterior problem. Here's omega. I tell you plus psi is zero. I tell you what psi does far away. So psi far away is like this. If I could tell you what it does on the boundary, you could find psi. Well, but if I knew what it does on the boundary, then I wouldn't be talking about this, because that's what I'm trying to find. However, notice that psi is in W2, Laplace psi is cube psi, which is in LP. Okay? So, d psi d nu again, this is motivation. We'll have a much easier time of it later. But basically, the intuition is this is a solution in all of space, therefore it's smooth across the boundary. Since it's smooth across the boundary, from the exterior, this is the same of d psi d nu from the interior. But in the interior, d size is a solution of this equation. And the Dirichlet-Neumann map takes that to its normal derivative. So this is lambda q of psi interior restricted to the boundary. But the lambda dq interior is the same as the lambda dq exterior. And so to make a long story short, we have a condition on the boundary. D psi d nu, if you wish exterior, is lambda q psi on the boundary. So summarized in words, what this says is that outside omega, psi solves the exterior problem that it's harmonic. It has the prescribed exponential growth at infinity. And its jump, if you wish, is given by the Dirichlet-Neumann map. Well, not jump. It's the relation between its normal derivative and its bound, and its so the relation between its Neumann and Dirichlet data is given by Dirichlet-Neumann. Oh, because this is all of. Oh, because this is enough. You could put W1 if you here. I don't care. Again, this is informal. So the point is, I can show that this exterior problem has a unique solution. So claim this is uniquely solvable if and only if K is not an exceptional point. And what does that buy me? Well, if you look at this problem in the box, the only thing you need to know is the Dirichlet-Neumann map. There's no Q here. We are outside. So if I give you the Dirichlet-Neumann map, and this has a unique solution, you have determined psi outside, and in particular, its boundary value. Once you do that, you plug it into this formula, you have T, and that accomplishes step one. Why not? No. Constructive doesn't mean formula. What I can do is I write an integral equation on the boundary. But I mean, if I give you this operator, you know, people do numerically solve exterior problems. So you numerically solve the exterior problem, that's constructive. But it's not a formula. Just as here, step two, which says solve this, something like that, this is also constructive, but it's not a formula. So one one can do this numerically. If I give you T, you can do this. And people are doing it, by the way. People have taken this method and turned it, made it numerical. But that doesn't mean it's a formula. Once you have psi, this is a formula. Same way here as once you have mu, this is a formula. All right. So let's call this quadruple star. So we'll solve quadruple star by turning it into a linear integral equation on the boundary. So this is an exterior problem, but it's not one you can look up in books, right? Because this is an unusual condition at infinity, and this is an unusual condition on the boundary. However, what can you find in books? You can find ways of taking exterior problems and using layer potentials to turn them into boundary integral equations. So So we do this using the single layer potential. Corresponding to Fadeyev's Green function. So what's a layer potential? You take a Green's function. And so this is a crash course on layer potentials. Now, why do you do this? Again, the aim is to change, right? Differential equations with boundary conditions can somehow be related to integral equations. And integral equations, you can use functional analytic methods to try to, or numerical methods to try to solve them. Yes, I'm getting to that. So physically what people do to do this is they say, well, here is the field corresponding to a point charge. Point charge, so let's call this x minus y. This is Laplacian in x, is delta x minus y. A point charge at y. This is in R2, right? So you put a point charge at any place y, And this is the corresponding field. So let's look for a solution psi, which is a superposition of such fields. So what density of point charges? So I put for every y, I decide this is how much weight I should give it, f of y. So think of this as a linear combination of fields corresponding to point charges at different y's with y on the boundary. So that's roughly the physical intuition behind this method. Now, physically, people usually use the standard Green's function for the Laplacian, log x minus y, something like that, in 2D. The problem is that the behavior of this for large x is inherited of this, sorry, behavior of this for large x is inherited from the behavior of this for large x. So this gives you the wrong behavior at infinity for us. Therefore, we're going to, that's why I didn't put anything here, we're going to play the same game but with new layer potentials made up of new Green's functions. So recall GK is e to the ikz, little gk, and little gk is our so you make the ansatz. Gk is e to the ikz times some little gk. Substitute in Laplace, you get this equation for little gk, or little gk is 1 over 2 pi squared by the Fourier transform e to the ix xi squared plus 4k xi, I believe. No, 2kxi, dxi. Right, because d bar has a 1/2 in it. Right, so xi1 plus ixi2. So recall the operator mk that we played with, mkf, is defined by gk convolved f. So we have great estimates which came into this construction of mu for little g. But now I want a Green's function for the Laplacian, so I put back the exponential. All right, now, so initially I had rather complicated ways of reducing the exterior problem. To an integral equation on the boundary. Here's a simple way. Okay? So simply apply triple star again. With V equal, so all right, sorry, as follows. Fix X not in omega. And let V, do I want X or do I want maybe, let V of Y equal G X minus Y. Then, and also U is psi yk. Then V is harmonic in omega. Right? In other words, if I put a point source here, Laplace G is delta. So away from the source, if the source is outside omega, away from this, G is a nice harmonic function. So let's substitute that in triple star. Substituting in triple star, we find right. U is unknown. But if you do this, what we find is lambda q minus lambda 0 psi on the boundary of y and k gk x minus y d sigma of y which, by the way, is the single layer, lambda q minus lambda 0, psi on the boundary. Right? Compare this with that. And now by triple star, this is the integral inside omega of G Q psi. Now, what can we say about this? Maybe I'll say it. Where should I say it? Maybe I'll say it in here. Now recall mu was obtained what's the definition of psi? Psi solves an integral equation as the solution of the integral equation mu equals 1 minus m, well, mk q mu. Right? That's how we proved theorem 1, which is 1 minus gk q mu. So psi is e to the ikz minus e to the ikz gk q. Let's put e to the minus ik y q psi. So psi of x and k is e to the ikz minus this is capital G. So this is equal to, this hopeless looking integral is in fact just e to the ikz minus psi. So we have shown that for all x not in omega, psi xk is e to the ikz minus sk lambda minus lambda 0 psi. Which, by the way, is a formula for psi outside omega if you know it on the boundary. So letting x approach the boundary, we get the integral equation psi on the boundary is eikz minus, it turns out single layer is continuous up to the boundary, same is the same as dot, right? You could write e to the ik dot if you... So yeah, it's a bit... So this is now, let's call it 4-5 stars. Okay, so what have I shown you? I've shown you that using this little identity, we've done two things. One is we found a formula for T in terms of psi on the boundary. And two, we showed that psi on the boundary satisfies this integral equation. So in fact, this integral equation is equivalent to this exterior problem. So, but I only told you about the exterior problem to somehow get some intuition of what this integral equation came from. But at this point, you can forget about this. You simply say psi on the boundary satisfies that equation. Okay? So the exterior problem was just a crutch for our motivation. So the way step one will be completed is to prove that this integral equation on the boundary is uniquely solvable.